We're going to give a little time to here is Representative Dwyer, who has suggested some substantial amendments for the committee to look at. I believe Representative Dwyer would like to walk us through this. So Representative Dwyer, with that, please take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bill Dwyer, State Representative, District 42, Springfield. What you have before you is HB 3470-1, which is a literal gut and stuff in terms of I didn't try to rework the other bill because it would have created taken so much time that I kind of, from my own point of view, designed what I thought would be something that may be acceptable to 95% of the people that happen to utilize firearms like myself and happen to hunt and enjoy the ownership of them. Those things that I have designed in here are not without controversy, however, because whenever you start dealing with weapons, you generate some kind of conflict. And I think the most controversial point of this bill will be in Section 1, which is the definition now of what an assault weapon is. If you recall, the whole need for this bill began with some kook in California who used an AK-47 to kill some kids on a school ground. He could have probably killed a heck of a lot more kids if he used a Ruger 10/22 with a 50-shot clip. He wouldn't have made so much noise, and they wouldn't have known what was happening until they started dropping like flies. But that just illustrates to me that you can't legislate maniacs. But, however, I tried to be constructive in this in regards to focusing in on what the original and what the original act that was demonstrated to affect the need. I also, as a person that's had a concealed weapon permit for many years, I've tried to address those questions and a lot of other questions. And I'll just briefly walk you through it. As I said, the Section 1 is the assault weapon definition.
Mr. Chair?
Of two.
Excuse me, Bill. I wonder, before you start going through section by section, can you step back a little bit and just in an overview fashion tell us the main differences between the original bill that was put in front of us and this one?
All right. Basically, this bill does not require anyone to have their fingerprints taken for anything except an assault weapon. It doesn't change the waiting periods at all for a concealed weapons permit or the purchase of a handgun. It utilizes all current federal forms and state forms in the purchase and whatnot of firearms. It it still treats the commission of a crime with a firearm as a special thing, so it penalizes the illegal use. It basically contains a statute that preempts local government's ability to control weapons, so we wouldn't have a Morton Grove type of a situation. It still utilizes a study, but in terms of the study, what it does is it requires the police to examine the transactions that occurred 1 year from 1988, the last year, and to determine if the local law enforcement agency receiving the duplicate sheet actually conducted a record, determine what the local law enforcement agency did with the results of the record check, take a random sampling of the applications for purchase and conduct record checks on applicants, and to submit the results of that study to the next session of the legislature. It's a lot less cumbersome on citizens, and this bill also would require those people in charge of getting these forms to conduct the study. Under current law, you fill out all this paper, and they send it to the police, and they stick it in the top drawer. And then somebody goes off the deep end and commits a crime, and they say, oh, my God. Well, they didn't even bother to check the person out in the first place. Well, whose is that? Whose fault is that? It's the authority's fault because it's easier not to do anything. And I think we ought to make a real determination of exactly what they've been doing with this, and this type of study will enable them to do that. As I said, Section 30 as simple a little language in terms of preemption. It does require a sheriff to issue a concealed weapons permit if a person is lays out the present criteria for the issuance of that, except that it changes from may to shall, and it doesn't charge quite as much. It charges $20 for an application fee and $25 for a biannual renewal, where you only have to have it renewed every 2 years. There's a provision for revoking permits in there, and also it licenses the person and not the weapon. It's got a lot of really good ideas in there, and like I said, the biggest thing that we'll have to fix is the definition of an assault weapon. And it also would grandfather all current weapons, so any weapon that's owned would not be subject to that now anyway. So I just tried to be constructive. I'd like to walk you through it, but all the forms that you'll see here are current forms that are presently used by law enforcement agencies or firearms dealers or county sheriffs to issue concealed weapons permit, and that comprises quite a bit of it. And it talks about the things that people that can't buy firearms and unless relief has been granted under Section 11, which simply says that if you're refused a concealed weapons permit, that you have the ability under this law to mandamus the sheriff to comply. And so that's a lot of the stuff that the original bill encompassed, except that I think that the 95 or 98% of the average people that like firearms and weapons and like to carry them and whatnot are not affected by this. It addresses the problem that the catalyst that triggered this type of a bill in the first place, and doesn't affect people that want to hunt and shoot and collect, doesn't require them to get their fingerprints, doesn't require them to wait longer for a handgun. Fact of the matter is, under this bill, if you have a concealed weapons permit, there is no waiting period for a handgun if you have a concealed weapons permit or you're a bona fide police officer. If the reason for this check is to see whether or not you're entitled to own a weapon, then certainly police officers and those people that have undergone the scrutiny of those kinds of checks deserve to have that privilege. And, people said to me, well, gee whiz, I wish you'd have run this by me earlier so we could have got a chance to look at it. Well, let me tell you, I just got it today out of a legislative council, and they didn't run any of their garbage by me before I got to look at it, so I think we're even.
Appreciate that response to Representative Clark's question. Is there anything in particular else you want to address about the amendments? Or?
Well, only that this will give us a real handle on being able to require those people that are empowered with enforcing the law to actually check the records, because the change is made to shall, and it will conduct a study that will examine how we've been treating these things, so we will know what we're doing before we move into some other area and then require fingerprinting and whatnot. And in terms of Section 32, which is the Ways and Means referral, I've talked to legislative fiscal, and the study isn't going to be very expensive. He's doing an analysis for me right now, because this is pretty easily applied. So I think we could probably delete the referral to Ways and Means and get on with it. If we're going to have a bill, or if we're going to have something that adversely impacts those people that like to own and use guns, like myself, then I just assume not to have a bill. That's it. That's the bottom line. Because I'm happy right now with you leaving me alone.
To Chair. One other question, Bill. Can you talk to me a little bit about the definition of assault weapon that you've got?
Well, that's the biggest hurdle that I see. What I tried to do is I recognize that most of the assault weapons, the AK-47, the AR-15s and whatnot, are .223 caliber. That's most of them. The trouble is, when you get into the Uzis and the 10 millimeters, and you get into these all these small pistols that have clip-fed, that they're bigger than .223, but they're still classified as I think, as handguns because of the barrel length. So you're required to undergo a check like you would on a handgun. So you just don't go buy them. What this doesn't prevent you from buying these kinds of weapons. The thing, if you want to buy an assault weapon that's capable of holding 200 rounds, you can do it. It just requires that when you buy that kind of weapon, you undergo a little bit more scrutiny than you do when you go and you buy a normal hunting rifle, because it's not used for hunting, it's used for something else. But it doesn't prevent your ownership. So as a consequence, that kind of approach doesn't impact 95% of the people that don't utilize those kinds of weapons and are concerned about their weapons. And it doesn't impact anybody that has a federal firearms license or impact anybody that has concealed weapons permit or police officers or whatnot. So we have to minimize the conflict that this kind of a bill causes, the grief to the average population. It's a kind of a thing that requiring them to undergo fingerprinting and all kinds of jump through hoops to buy weapons that are used in normal course of hunting, when the real catalyst was some kook in California with this assault weapon. So I tried to focus on that, but it's not an easy task, because conceivably, if I have a lot of clip-fed weapons. I got a 300 Savage and a few others that there aren't those kinds of big banana clips for that weapon, but I would think that if you did a little work, you could probably alter it to accept that kind of clip, and as such, maybe bring it under the definition of an assault weapon. I don't really know what the heck the answer is. The only thing that I know, that 95% of the weapons that are already used by the people in Oregon, all of those weapons would be exempt, and 95% of the new ones that are purchased would not come under this category. And it may even entice manufacturers to go away from clip-fed type weapons to other types that are fed, so to limit the capacity and still not impact a person's ability to really to have fun.
Okay. Last question, Mr. Chair. Bill, I want to continue to play devil's advocate for a minute, because I appreciate you put a lot of work into the amendment, and I want to see how far we can go with working on it. If I didn't like guns, let's say I was a local sheriff or a city councilor or a mayor, and I didn't like guns at all, could I take the definition of assault weapon that you've given there and twist it around somehow and use it to get at weapons that you didn't intend? You couldn't do anything.
If you turn to Section 30 of this bill on page 36 on the bottom, it answers your question.
What was it, page 30?
Page 36, Section 30. It says, no city, county, or other political subdivision of the state shall prohibit or regulate the ownership of firearms in this state. So we don't have to worry about what some local government type might want to do with it, because the authority is totally left with the state, and so it's clear that they have no ability to regulate.
Bill, I had a question. What if the major concerns that you're pointing out are that there are a lot of things in this bill that are going to affect law-abiding citizens and your average hunter's type of rights to obtain and use firearms? What if we were to correct some of the problems in the original bill?
Well, that's what I tried to do in this bill, and let me tell you, I have no proprietary interest in this. If all those folks that are signed on this bill want to utilize this, what I found that it was just a lot easier for me to totally rewrite the bill to have it do what I felt was the catalyst that formed this and not adversely impact those people. Now, like I said, the biggest crutch in this whole thing is the definition of an assault weapon. And I tried to define it using 223 and larger, capable of firing more than 10 rounds, because I eliminate most of the 95% of the hunting rifles, all the 10-22 Rugers and 222s and all those kinds of guns, and all the guns that the kids go out and plink, and go down to Bi-Mart and buy 50 round banana clips for them right now. I mean, they're the Rams. There's about five different manufacturers that make these banana clips, and you know, I've got several of them, and the kids and I, we go out and we put a 50 rounder in there, and we just burn up the ammo, and you know, we do it and we enjoy it, but that won't affect us. But if some guy has been on destruction and wants to go in a schoolyard and kill kids or kill anybody, I'll tell you that 10/22 is a lot more effective weapon than an AK-47, because it's a hell of a lot more accurate. It doesn't make as much noise. And by the time people realize what's happening, it's too late. But you can't legislate morality. We do have the right to own firearms. Let's be sensible about it and not impact the population and have them conceive us to be their enemy. I would ask that you, before you try to piecemeal something together, and the same way with Holly, I'll let you walk through her, that before you try to move something together in this thing, is you spend a little time in looking at what Holly did, looking at the original bill, and looking at the rewrite that I have, and then I think you'd probably find it a lot easier to amend what I've done than it is to amend the original bill.
Mr. Chair? Bill, before you get away, tell me where, I mean, I see your definition of assault weapon. I'm looking for where in the bill the operative provisions are about assault weapons.
Page 8, Section 3.
Thank you, counsel.
And it has a special form that they fill out, and that goes, it has a special waiting period of 15 days, and it goes to the police. And so if you buy that kind of weapon, you have to go through a little tougher thing. It doesn't say that you can't get it, but it doesn't affect all these people who want to go down and they want to buy a Browning automatic, or they want to buy a Remington 742 or some automatic that other type of a gun, or you know, so we're trying to focus. And
Representative Dwyer, historically, one of the strange twists about the issue of the right to keep and bear arms is that it was related heavily to the militia, and for a long time, the courts were saying that actually that meant that you could only apply the right to military-style weapons, because if they weren't military-style weapons, they couldn't be used by the militia. Maybe we're talking more than 50, 70 years ago. But now we've come full circle. Now you're suggesting to us that we should be able to impose some registration requirements on military-style weapons. And my concern is, if we're talking about the right to keep and bear arms, the whole idea of the right to keep and bear arms was our right to not just protect ourselves against criminals, but to protect our society generally against the tyranny of a despotic government.
That's why I keep... That's exactly why I keep my weapons. I don't keep them to take care of the burglars.
But, you know, when you register them the way you're suggesting in your bill, any kind of a weapon, the next thing you do is, when you have a despotic government, all they have to do is look up the registration and go out and pick them up.
Well, that's true. But let me.
We got to keep the noise and.
Let me carry that a little further, though, in terms of what you would rather them do. First of all, it doesn't impact any existing weapon, regardless of kind. You know, and I know the history of the totalitarianism between Czechoslovakia and what those kinds of governments have done in order to disarm their people, and I have concerns about that. In terms of your interpretation of the militia, now, I mean, you want to take that technical interpretation. If the militia was just to be defined as the military in terms of George Washington or prior to the formation of this country, then the only people that would have had any arms would have been King George and his henchmen. But you see, the militia was the people, and it wasn't people in the army. It was...
You're misunderstanding me, Representative Dwyer. I understand that. I'm recognizing that the people are the militia. What I'm getting at is, the original thrust of House Bill 3470 was we're trying to avoid...
Well, let me
that.
Tell you
Wait
then...
Listen to my question. This is what I'm concerned about. We're trying to identify felons and mentally ill people who shouldn't have their hands on weapons and have a system where we can say, hey, wait a minute, you've got a criminal background. I'm not going to sell you a gun. And not have a system, though, where there's some central government registry where we can track down everybody who does have guns.
This prohibits that specifically, as did the original one. This doesn't prohibit you from getting the kind of weapon. If you would, like I said in the beginning, if you want to take that out of there and go to less, if you really want to address the problem that considered that demonstrated the need for this in the first place, and I think this does. As I said in the beginning, if you leave me alone and you don't do anything, you won't make me a bit mad.
Not going to be able to get any work done. We might actually start moving through.
But
some
I would
amendments.
Ask that you just really go through it and analyze, and let Holly give you side by side. Because if you want to piecemeal something together, it'll be a heck of a lot easier if you use my amendment. And I
appreciate
don't want any credit for it. I just want to try to protect everyone.
Appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much, Representative Dwyer.
Thanks, Bill.
I think we have some invited testimony from the ACLU on the invitation of Representative Clark, and I'd like to bring them up here.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Clark.
If I can just explain a little bit why I asked Ms. Remington to be here. As I went through the bill first time, I kept wondering not only about the constitutional right to keep and bear arms, but also about the Oregon State Constitution and its treatment of the right to keep and bear arms. And also, there are a couple of other provisions in the original bill that raised some issues in my mind. I guess existing law prohibits the advertising of sale of handguns. Is that correct? And I guess I'd like your feedback on that and on the whole question.
Mr. Chair, Stevie Remington, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, and I'm distributing to you the national ACLU policy on gun control. Substantially, it is that we share the view of the Supreme Court in the 30s. The Second Amendment does not confer an individual right rather than a collective right for militia. And I want to recognize the difference between that and the Oregon Constitution, which, of course, does have a specific provision that says that you have a right to bear arms for the defense of yourself and your property. But at any rate, we have remained neutral. We feel that although we can't say all regulation and of handguns or anything else is necessarily unconstitutional under the federal constitution, we are concerned about the process, whether there are due process issues, invasions of privacy, whether the enforcement will result in unreasonable searches and seizures, and so we are neutral on the subject of regulation per se, but may be concerned about individual things. I don't know the case law on it. I don't know when anything was litigated, if so, on this First Amendment or free speech question of the poster. I do know that under the analysis, as we have seen it evolve in the Ackerley billboard cases and so on, and the free speech cases on expression, in our opinion, that would be struck down as unconstitutional because it seems to me clearly to be discrimination on the basis of the content of speech, which I think the Oregon Supreme Court has said one cannot do. The other area of major concern for us in this bill are the required reportings. I know that you had testimony on that at the last one, and I would just like to state that we would share the opinion of the Oregon Psychiatric Association, and we would like to see what is the substance of Section 4 done away with. Those were the only two issues that we quickly identified as matters of concern for us.
Mr. Chair? Yeah, I just have a couple of questions to ask you, Stevie, and recognizing that maybe you could bring answers back to us, because I'm not expecting you to be able to answer these off the top of your head. I don't know whether it would be possible in the remaining period of time that we have to work on this bill to get an ACLU of Oregon position on the meaning of the Oregon Constitution provision. But it seems to me to be fairly fundamental to the issue in front of us. And secondly, the fingerprinting issue. The original bill had proposed that, as I read it, anytime someone wants to buy a gun in the state, they were going to be fingerprinted. And I'd like to get the ACLU's input on that from the standpoint of invasion of privacy. And I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and just thank Ms. Remington for coming.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we have generally disfavored, as a matter of policy, fingerprinting. We've lost our litigation on that, at least in the federal courts. Where I remember one of the big cases went up was fingerprinting all teachers in the New York school system, and that was held to be constitutional. As a matter of policy, we do oppose that thing. In response to your question on getting a policy, I don't think it would be possible during the time that's left. But I did raise this with one of our board members since I spoke with Hugh, and he felt definitely that we should have a committee work on this. But given our record on developing policy and the argumentativeness within our own body, it does take a while.
Right. Well, I just think the point needs to be raised that we're in a time where our state constitution is being construed independently of the federal constitution. And here's an example where very clearly the state constitution uses different words and appears to be getting at a different policy, and is very specific about the right to keep and bear arms for the defense of oneself. And it seems to me that we need to pay attention to the state constitution on this issue as well as the federal constitution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I did a couple of sessions ago when the courts first started ruling unconstitutional statutes that banned mere possession and made it a crime. We did keep revising the statutes, right, and we did testify that you can't do this anymore.
Okay. Thank you.
As a follow-up to what Representative Clark was asking about, again, this looks like an issue where the Oregon Constitution sets a different set of protections, because you mentioned the collective right in your interpretation of the federal constitution, but here it says the people shall have the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. And saying that, there's obviously a distinction there between the people and the state, and I would read that to mean that I have the right to bear arms under the Oregon Constitution for my defense, or the defense of people among me, separate from the collective security notion of the state. And are you agreeing with that interpretation?
Certainly. I thought I made that statement, that I recognized
probably
the difference.
Probably missed it while I was reading the Constitution in the corner.
Yes, I
thank you.
Completely agree.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Stevie, I'd just like to thank Ms. Remington for coming in.
Thank you.
Still have many, but we're still here working anyway. Let's get in, if we can, what we're going to do is get into analysis from our fine learned counsel on the bill, and then we've got a list of the amendments in a fairly succinct working order of the ones that we have to potentially we'll be able to get to today to look at, or at least begin to consider. I think that our plan is to try to have another meeting a week from tomorrow and have a updated version of whatever we've butchered into.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we can approach this in a couple of different ways, particularly given Representative Dwyer's amendments. My suggestion, I think, would be this. Let me spend 5 minutes just doing an overview of House Bill 3470 as written. Then what we'll next do is explain to you the working document that I've put together for the committee's consideration, just with an overview of what is contained in it and how I anticipate the committee can use it. And then if the committee is interested, before we jump into that, I can do just a brief comparison between Representative Dwyer's bill and 3470, because I have prepared that as well. As Representative Dwyer pointed out, his bill's got 33 sections. House Bill 3470 has 32 sections. Having been through all of this, it would certainly be my recommendation to the committee that the committee approach it on a section-by-section basis, resolve the issues that are presented in that section or clumps of sections. In actuality, parts of the bill could even be broken off into other bills, and I think that will be the cleanest and the least confusing way to do it, both for committee members and members of the audience who are trying to follow what the committee is doing. So, with that, let me do just a brief summary of 3470 as written, and then we can go from there to the working document. I'm going to start by confusing you. In the Dash 1 amendments, Representative Dwyer started with a new Section 1, which is actually Section 12 of 3470. Section 12 is the definition section of the bill. It has some new definitions. It's going to be recommended we add some, but that's where the bill starts, is really Section 12, which is the new definition section. Section 1 of 3470 changes the requirements for purchase of handguns in a couple of different ways. It has a much more detailed register. There is a 15-day waiting period. All applicants
But that's just my opinion.
It's my intent, at least, to go through each and every proposed amendment and evaluate it. Certainly work from the printed document and satisfy. Brought us some excellent language, particularly with respect to preemption. That I'd expressed to counsel. And we weren't sure exactly how we were going to handle that. Mr. Miller, any questions?
Comments? Well, I guess even Mr. Burke put Representative Bryan said I'm probably more comfortable working with Representative Wire as Burke.
Representative Clark?
I don't think whichever version we we're probably going to take this to the contract in both of those aspects. So, I mean, there's some very clear.
I think the sense I get from the committee is it doesn't make a lot of difference at this point. We'll pursue it. If we run into any difficulties, we may structure the bill such that it's beyond. I think that council's put together some on the working document proposals for amendments that are in order with the present 3470 language, so we probably ought to pursue that language, and then if we run into any
that's what all I'm saying is that everything we've done has been oriented towards those sections. A lot of the testimony and submissions we've received from the public have referenced specific sections and so forth, and it would be easier to track those back if we work from the base document.
Council, why don't you take us through the first proposed amendment that we have on the document for House Bill 3470, and we'll add on it.
Okay. It has been suggested, and Representative Dwyer ended up doing the same thing, of moving, as I said earlier, the definition section up front. The committee, if they want to open the bill, should be looking at Section 12. There was a term added to the current criminal code that talks about misdemeanors involving violence. The reason that that term was adopted was that if a person had been convicted of a misdemeanor involving violence within a period of time 4 years preceding the purchase of a firearm or the application of a concealed weapons license, that they would be ineligible. However, 3470 did not define.
Thanks.
3470 did not define misdemeanor involving violence. There were two suggestions made about how to handle this. The first one that you see in your working document is basically a parroting or adaptation of the federal language, which defines crimes of violence, and that's listed on working documents in the lines 16 through 21, which basically is use of physical force against persons or property, or the risk of physical force or personal property. When this issue was raised with the working group that was basically the proponents of the bill, this was acceptable to them. The other option, obviously, well, let me just finish on this. If the committee chooses, I think, to adopt something like misdemeanors of violence, and the legislative record is clear that we are adopting basically the federal definition of crimes of violence, which is in fact limited to felony offenses, but the intent is the same, then I think that you've got a body of case law that would define or interpret what crimes of violence are. The other option that was presented to the committee was to list every misdemeanor that would fall into the category of crimes of violence. That seems to be somewhat cumbersome, but I think it is an option that is available to the committee. The other option, I think, would be to not define it, but that's always an option. As an attorney, it's hard for me to say don't define it, but you don't have to define it. But it is a term that comes up throughout the statute. It also is one that, regardless of which bill we use, has been incorporated by Representative Dwyer as well.
If there are representatives from the working group that was worked with in the room, I think maybe we should bring them forward as we walk through these amendments and vote. Would we have? I think we have at least. Let's bring these people up so we can get some. We need to get feedback on each one of these specific amendments as we go through it. This one I don't think is going to be very controversial to begin with, but at least whether or not all the parties to the agreement were in support, or if they're not in support, why not?
Mr. Chair.
Well, yes. I have. Let me just clarify something.
Yes.
Some of these amendments were originally presented to that working group, whatever that working group was. If they was acceptable to them, it is so noted in here.
Okay,
I'm just wondering.
In your working document?
Yes. For example, I see on lines 25 and 26 of my working document, it said it was acceptable.
Okay, Representative Clark.
Well, two things. I think for benefit of the audience, it's helpful to know why we're paying attention to this mystical invisible working group, and it simply lets us know how much opposition there's going to be to a particular change in the bill. I guess the other question I would ask is it the chair's intent to walk us through amendments one by one and deal with the policy issues as they come along, or take the policy issues right up front and see where we are, see if there's a bill left when we finish voting on those policy issues?
It was my intent, and I'll take suggestions, to get the people that we're able to have in terms of any expertise to take each individual session at a time, because I think that there are large policy each area. And if there are a couple members of the committee that stress an interest in making a change, receive input from the people that worked on the section to find out what the reason is, why in the heck is it in there in the first place, what the merits are for taking it out, what kind of compromise can be struck,
okay.
And
that's fine.
Then take it from there.
Mr. Chairman,
if there's a better suggestion, I'll be willing to. Representative Clark.
Chairman, I appreciate the working group being involved in this, but it's been my impression throughout the hearings that a considerable segment of the public was not very impressed with the work product of the working group, and I think we would not serve our purpose very well if we excluded others who might be here who would be willing to participate.
I think it was my intent in being able to use the working group not to make their input, the exclusive input. I hope that we have five people on this panel that, and maybe some others that can help us to represent the public, and that way we can represent the public and ask the questions that the public would want to ask about some of these proposals.
I just, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I'm not as expert as some of you are on this issue, and it is helpful to me to have others who know a great deal about this subject to who were not part of that working group. Indeed, I think Representative Dwyer made it rather clear that he was probably intentionally excluded, and his comments and those of similar feelings, similar expertise would be helpful to me personally.
Mr. Chairman.
Jim, appreciate the comment. I hope we can work those people in. Representative Mannix.
My recommendation as to procedure would be as follows. And this is based on really what I'll call the Mason-Bauman approach to working complicated, lengthy bills, that members of the public who are interested and involved should feel free to contact individual members of the committee with their concerns about particular sections and any proposed language that addresses their concerns or omission of language that addresses their concerns. Obviously, we're not going to have a single work session to work over this whole bill. The people are here. They know who they are. They can contact us about those concerns, or they can contact their own representatives if they wish, if they're not from our districts, and work through them. But that as we go through this, that we prepare a list of policy issues that need to be addressed, and that we know in advance of, say, the next hearing what that list of policy issues is, so that each of us can add or subtract from that list or suggest additions or subtractions. I assume that any policy issue raised by a member of this committee would be on that list. That we can then go through those policy issues and discuss them and, in effect, get a straw poll. And if everyone on this committee is saying, oh, that's awful, well, we know pretty well where the drift is. Or if they say, gee, that's a pretty neat idea, we know what that drift is. Or if they say, that needs work, we know what the drift is. That in terms of efficiency and time, if we take that approach, one, the public knows what are the issues that are being addressed vis-a-vis the original bill. This is the filed bill that's in front of the committee, including the Dwyer amendments and any other amendments. But say on issue A, there are three different amendments. Well, that to me tells me that there are three options on issue A, and I'd rather not deal with option one and then a day later find out that there was an option two on that issue and the day after that that there was an option three. I'd like to see the options raised, regardless of whose amendment it is, item by item as we go through this, on the issues. There are a lot of technical minor things that can be done to this bill, in my opinion, to clean up some of the language, and I truly mean technical. For instance, the triplicate forms, I really think it's foolish to have all three versions of the form in here when the word changes, or there's only a couple of words changed on the third of the three forms. Little things like that can be dealt with by the members of the committee in a work session. We can just say, someone can come in and say, look, scratch this out, and we'll go from there. But if we don't approach it on a listing of optional issues, as we've done even in Family Justice with Representative Courtney's subcommittee, we're going to end up bogged down on page one while we look at five different versions of what ought to be done, when actually five pages of the bill may relate to that policy issue, and there may be three other amendments on other pages that all tie in. So my recommendation, Mr. Chairman, is that we go through now and simply try to list the policy issues that we're presented with as a working list of issues, taking them off the documentation that's prepared by counsel, but some of those we may decide are not worrisome issues. Some of them we could just say, that's not a policy issue, we're all okay on that, or we may say, forget it, we're not going to do that anyway. That's my recommendation, Mr. Chairman, something along those lines.
Appreciate that. I think we can incorporate that also. Let me see if I can be clear about one option we would have. Given the work that counsel's already done on the working document, we could look at House Bill 3470, taking it section by section, and some of the proposed amendments that are already mentioned in here, try to work our way through here with conceptual and specific amendments, and then get a whole nother version of the bill after we'd fixed some of the things that we were concerned about, even if only conceptually, and then just go right back through the bill again and work it one more time.
I agree, Mr. Chairman. We could just go back through the summary and say, all right, I see this problem. I don't like this. This I want to work on. There may be other things that we just glide over, but then we'll know what we're focusing on in terms of a total picture.
Any comments from council about her preference, given all her diligent work in this regard?
Well, I think perhaps to respond to Representative Mannix's comment, and if the rest of the committee would like me to, what I can do is walk through my document at this point and highlight what I think are the policy issues, what I see as the policy definitions. There's tons of technical stuff, which also happens to be in here, but we can do that, and if there's consensus on that, then maybe that's the list the committee wants to start working on today.
I have no problem with starting out with this as the topics sheet. I have a feeling there are going to be some additions as we go along, but I have no problem with that. I just want us to have that format, that approach.
Okay. Well, then why don't I walk through this? I'll take out my red pen. I can highlight what I see are sort of the larger policy issues as I have distilled them, and then we can add to them if somebody wants. I mean, this can also be modified by turning on the computer. And then if we want to add to them, and then decide how we want to do them. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay.
Please pursue that.
Okay. We don't have to define it now, but I think there is an issue of whether or not we define misdemeanors of violence. It is not currently defined in the statute. I think that the committee has to decide whether or not they want to define it, and if so, how they're going to define it, because the impact of it is significant. So you don't have to use my definition, but deciding to define it and how to define it,
Mr. Chair,
I perceive as a policy issue.
Mr. Clark,
not a technical issue.
I would move the definition of misdemeanor involving violence set out in the federal statute on page 1 of the working document, lines 16 through 21. And I would also, as part of that motion, intend to incorporate whatever federal case law is out there interpreting that phrase. The reason being, I don't feel comfortable leaving the phrase totally undefined, and I also don't feel comfortable going through listing every single misdemeanor in the Oregon Revised Statutes that we think involves violence. And I think we need to give the courts some guidance, but I'm not willing to spend 2 weeks defining misdemeanors of violence.
I wasn't quite sure what council wanted to do. Do you want to go through the whole list of these and then we can come back and start moving them, or do you want to move them as you go through? You put a lot of work into this. Any preference of the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Mr. Mannix.
My preference is that these be what I'd call informal discussions, saying I'd like to do this and see if people are opposed to it without the formality of motions. But I agree with Representative Clark's whole approach here. Let's identify it, say I like this and see what other people say. If we know there's mixed emotions about it, at least we can note that, but it's an issue. When we have formal amendments in front of us, we can vote on it.
Can keep score for us so we know which ones we've talked about, which ones we haven't. I'll withdraw the motion and simply suggest that would be the approach that I would like to take. For those reasons.
I should also note that part of the reason this was done on lined paper was to facilitate motion making like that so that we could move this thing along.
Okay.
So we're in a format where that can be done, but I think that I will so note it and we can...
One more comment?
What?
Representative Mannix.
Let's just call them all conceptual amendments. If there's no objection, we're okay with it. If there is, then we note that and we'll have to have a formal motion later.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I can envision, for example, me or Representative Miller or someone else having a preference as to one particular way to approach something or another, but not being willing to sign off on the thing being part of the bill.
Formal consultation.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead. I think we have some things that will be fairly non-controversial. The first one would be to make Section 12 Section 1.
Let's
move that for right now and see if we have any objection to that motion. None. It's so ordered. The second amendment that we have that I don't think we may have much opposition to, and I hope somebody out there that worked on the bill will raise their hands if there is. I don't think this is a controversial one, is Representative Clark's motion that he just set forth the reasons for. Any discussion on that motion? Representative Baum.
You got a misdemeanors of violence raises to me assault 4.
I question if a person should lose their right to obtain a concealed weapon permit for 4 years for an assault 4 conviction. Well, that's the discussion.
Felony can be anything from a bar fight over any reason to abuse of a spouse or a child, or, you know, I mean, when you're into misdemeanors, you're into some potentially bad things, but some potentially trivial things, and they're going to have a lot of people out there that work in the blue-collar area that have occasion to run afoul of this law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baum, I have a recommendation. Let me raise a second issue for the committee to chew on, because I think that this is an issue that has been raised numerous times, and I think that Representative Baum's comments get to it as well. And this you may want to discuss this further. One of the policy issues that has been raised that the committee is going to have to grapple with is how to handle cases which were charged as felonies and person was convicted of a misdemeanor. And I think the whole issue of misdemeanor handling, whether it's a misdemeanor of violence, whether it was a plea bargain, whether it's a driving under the influence charge because it uses drugs and alcohol, the whole issue of how we want to how the committee wants to handle misdemeanors is going to be a very big discussion. So I think perhaps it may be better at this point to say there's a big issue involving misdemeanors of violence, misdemeanors that were a result of felony charges, misdemeanors that involve drugs and alcohol, and flag it and come back to it, or not if the committee's ready to it. But that there's a whole bunch of issues about what do you do with misdemeanors.
Do you want to attempt to get some guidance from some of the experts on this at this time and work this issue, or do we want to move on? I don't see why we shouldn't work it right now.
I think what we're trying to do is, if we go through this section by section, approve that section or amend it by consensus, or note that there is not a consensus, or put it to a vote and record that vote, work it through basically as far as we can go today, and we'll end up with essentially a dash two.
We'll have some more.
And we can circulate that and just keep refining it. But I think we need to take our first swat at this thing and go as far as we can in one day.
Your preference to flag this one right now and pursue it later then?
Yeah, if there is a concern about, there was a expressed intent to adopt this definition of misdemeanor. And if there's concern on the committee not to do that, then we'll just have to flag it. For now, I'm willing to put it in and use this for dash two purposes, and we can think about it, in a cleaned up version. And if we need to supplement it or refine it, we'll do it off of dash two.
Mr. Chairman?
Thanks.
I concur with Representative Bryan. I see several options here. First of all, my own opinion is we ought to go with convictions. Don't try to figure out what the charges were dropped down from. That's real hard to track. If you stick to convictions for felonies, you're clean. Get down to misdemeanor involving violence. If we're going to use that term, I want to use this definition. I still want to think about Representative Baum's concern about, well, this could be assault for, it could be a barroom fight. I mean, there could be a lot of things. We may or may not want to say the consequence is you're kept out of certain firearms possession rights. Some of us may say that's okay. I would suggest that the alternative be 1 4 years misdemeanor involving violence. We also think about 2 years misdemeanor involving violence, or 1 year, or dropping the whole provision entirely, all as options, and we'll have to think about it.
What about making it discretionary? Would that be something that we might want to...
Discretionary with who?
Right now.
The sheriff.
No.
With respect to this.
No, because the sheriff won't. No, that wouldn't work. But I think... Now, remember, though, that the purpose of this amendment is for definition and purposes only. It's so you can put it in as a definition, and then how you subsequently use it as the committee works through the bill, you can modify. I think it's critical, probably, to define it, because it's there. If you end up taking it out at the end, that's fine too, but it's there. You got to have a working definition.
I think we're agreed on that.
We're quarreling quite a bit with the underlying policy.
I kind of look at Mr. Chairman. Let's go at
causing.
This in big chunks, kind of rough. Okay. And we've got, I've got, things that the people have given us in testimony, and I'm going to be flipping through. I've got 5 or 6 sets of proposed amendments.
One of the questions we'd have to raise here is, would you want a person that's convicted to say harassment, or what would be one of the lower crime of violence?
Well, I'm not sure that harassment would necessarily fall in here.
A lot of times it would depend on the circumstances of the particular act.
No, I think what's
instruction of the way this is written with property in here, it could be kicking in a door. It could be
significant criminal mischief and assault 4, I think, is probably what's included in.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend we move on to the next issue.
Let's move to the next one real quick.
What are we doing with this?
It's okay, but we got to think about how we're going to use it.
Okay.
We'll let people think about that.
Are you withdrawing your motion? Your motion's been withdrawn.
I did that 15 minutes ago.
All right. Okay.
But we've adopted by consensus. We're going to start with this definition.
Okay.
Right?
No objection. We'll start with this as a definition for that. No, so ordered. So okay. I guess Representative Clark, in fact, did not withdraw his motion.
That's right.
His motion carried because of his persuasive argument in favor of his motion.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Mannix.
On this next issue, the issue of defining found guilty but for insanity, the real problem in my interpretation, reading the bill several times, I paused at that phrase. It's the grammar and the structure of the language that's in there. I think that if we just play around with the grammar, I don't think that we need to put in the definition and everything else. It might be helpful to put in the statutory reference so people will know that we mean exactly as defined by statute. My recommendation is that we just go ahead and clean up the grammar. A couple of commas, as I recall, would have cleaned up the understanding of the bill in the first place.
Counsel, could you tell us about this issue?
Yes. The concern is this. If you look at, and I'll tell you exactly how it was presented to me, because I made it very clear to me. If you look at page 10, line 44 of the printed bill, that's not really where I want to be.
Page 7.
You can do it on page 7. Page 7?
At the bottom, line 41.
No. Actually, it was raised to me on page 10, and it doesn't really make sense there. But somebody is reading that. You know, I'm not an attorney, and I go into fill out one of these applications, and I'm saying I have never been convicted, that's true, or found guilty except for insanity. The person who's filling out this form doesn't understand what that means. Or the person who has to review the form and take the form and send it in because they're not lawyers and it happens to be a term of art.
Counsel.
Is where the confusion comes in.
I am a lawyer and I don't understand that phrase.
I think one way to solve it would be to say, pursuant to ORS, and at least you've made it clear that what you're doing is.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think that's the way to probably solve it, but that's the kinds of phone calls that I was getting, was people who were willing to fill out the form but didn't know what it meant, didn't know where to look, didn't know how to handle it.
It's
on page 9 also.
I think I can rationalize that for your benefit, is that the fact that there is no crime of insanity, and in fact, if you are insane, you cannot be guilty of a crime.
Bill, I
cannot be convicted.
My amendment in the other section
correct
spells that out, and it also adds in the fact that you're a judge to be in.
I understand all that, Bill.
There's an easy way out. Excuse me, Representative.
That's fine. All I was going to say is, and I gave up a long time ago on hoping that government-sponsored forms were going to be readable, but at least the ones that are in front of me, I'm going to try and make them so that anybody can walk in, read the form, and understand it. And the phrase, I have never been convicted or found guilty except for insanity in the state of Oregon or anywhere else of a felony.
I have an answer for you, I hope. You just break it down. Has been convicted of a felony. Next line. Has been found guilty, quote, found guilty except for insanity, unquote, of a felony. And then you put parentheses, meaning under ORS, whatever, that you were let off the hook because you were crazy. You can put in some simple language. You separate it so we know that when you've been convicted of a felony, it's a clear statement. Found guilty except for insanity of a felony, it's a clear separate statement. And if we do that throughout the bill, people will understand what we mean.
Is the original intent of the bill to
under ORS something
include or exclude these people in the ones that will be getting permits.
Exclude.
To exclude them.
All the crazies and the felons.
We're not saying that as long as you were crazy, we'll let you have the firearm. Okay. I think Representative Mannix's suggestion is a very good one.
You could even use simpler English and just say, has successfully used an insanity defense to a, has been
found guilty except for insanity under ORS.
Found guilty except for insanity under ORS in regard to a felony.
Let's take that language by consensus.
And it will have to go throughout the bill. Okay.
Chairman?
Unless you use the definitional phrase, on the form it's got to be explained because that's going to be sent out.
Representative
Bryan. Okay. Definition of police officer, we had talked about that. Would this be a place to put among our definitions? Should we put the definition or reference the definition?
I think we should put the police officers together with insanity. I think.
As we're listing our definitions,
Council, you're nodding, you're shaking your head.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, I think if you look in the dash one amendments on page 3, Representative Dwyer did what we were going to suggest, and I think that that's sufficient. I don't think you need to put it in the definition section, particularly the definition section that we're amending in order to do the rest of this.
Yeah. Would we need to use that twice, once at purchase, once at concealed weapon?
I don't know. I'll have to check that. I don't think so. I will check that. Okay.
Let's.
I want to let you know that as far as giving me the credit for being the author of all these questions, all these forms,
I'd like to reiterate that I simply use existing federal law, federal
forms, state concealed weapon laws, and all the questions that are currently asked.
So these
questions, either in a federal statute or in a state statute, are currently asked.
So instead of trying to create new language, you just use the current language.
Right. The people that fill out all these forms are already familiar with all these forms. They fill them out every day. And why should we invent a new process?
What's the committee think about that? Would it sound like a better way to go to try to just align these with the federal forms?
I agree with that.
Council, can we do that or?
We're
jumping around. We can't jump.
In section one.
Let's
definitions.
Okay.
Let's not jump.
Well, I don't understand Representative Bryan's concern. Where do we? There's a need for a definition of a police officer.
Yes.
Well then, I agree that we should put a definition in.
It could either be defined there or it can be defined there. Potentially two places where the reference is made to a police officer. One is eligibility for concealed weapon, and one is for the purchase of a weapon.
I'm sure there's a definition in the criminal code.
No, I'm shaking my head. If you look on page 3 of the dash 1 amendments.
Mm-hmm. 920, ORS 18161.
In the way that it's handled there is the way that it would be handled the other place.